Chapter 131. An easy manner induced him to pocket a handful of macaroons, which he discussed on his way to the theater, whither everybody went in the cheery social little German place. The lady in black, the boy's mama, laughed and blushed, and looked exceedingly pleased and shy as the dinner went on, and at the various feats and instances of espieglery on the part of her son. The colonel, for so he became very soon afterwards I remember, joked the boy with a great deal of grave fun, pointing out dishes which he hadn't tried, and entreating him not to balk his appetite, but to have a second supply of this or that. It was what they call a gastrol night at the Royal Grand Ducal Pumpernickelischhofer Court Theater, and Madame Schrieder Devrient, then in the bloom of her beauty and genius, performed the part of the heroine in the wonderful opera of Fidelio. From our places, in the stalls we could see our four friends of the table d'hôte in the loge which Schwendler of the Erbprinz kept for his best guests, and I could not help remarking the effect which the magnificent actress and music produced upon Mrs. Osborne, for so we heard the stout gentleman in the mustachios call her. During the astonishing chorus of the prisoners, over which the delightful voice of the actress rose, and soared in the most ravishing harmony, the English lady's face wore such an expression of wonder and delight, that it struck even little Phipps, the blasé attaché, who drawled out, as he fixed his glass upon her, "Gade, it really does one good to see a woman capable of that state of escapement." And in the prison scene, where Fidelio, rushing to her husband, cries, "Nix, Nix, main Floriston," she fairly lost herself and covered her face with her handkerchief. Every woman in the house was sniveling at the time, but I suppose it was because it was predestined that I was to write this particular lady's memoirs that I remarked her. The next day they gave another piece of Beethoven, Die Schlachtbühne Vittoria. Malbrook is introduced at the beginning of the performance, as indicative of the brisk advance of the French army. Then come drums, trumpets, thunders of artillery, and groans of the dying, and at last, in a grand triumphal swell, "God Save the King" is performed. There may have been a score of Englishmen in the house, but at the burst of that beloved and well-known music, every one of them, we young fellows in the stalls, Sir John and Lady Bulminster, who had taken a house at Pumpernickel for the education of their 9 children, the fat gentleman with the mustachios, the long major in white duck trousers, and the lady with the little boy upon whom he was so sweet, even Kirsch, the courier in the gallery, stood bolt upright in their places, and proclaimed themselves to be members of the dear old British nation. As for Tapeworm, the charge d'affaires, he rose up in his box and bowed and simpered, as if he would represent the whole empire. Tapeworm was nephew and heir of old Marshal Tipton, who has been introduced in this story as General Tipton, just before Waterloo, who was colonel of the TH regiment in which Major Dobbin served, and who died in this year full of honors, and of an aspic of plover's eggs, when the regiment was graciously given by His Majesty to Colonel Sir Michael O'Dowd, K.C.C.B., who had commanded it in many glorious fields. Tapeworm must have met with Colonel Dobbin at the house of the colonel's colonel, the marshal, for he recognized him on this night at the theater, and with the utmost condescension, His Majesty's minister came over from his own box, and publicly shook hands with his newfound friend. "Look at that infernal sly boots of a Tapeworm," Phipps whispered, examining his chief from the stalls. "Wherever there's a pretty woman he always twists himself in. And I wonder what were diplomatists made for but for that? Have I the honor of addressing myself to Mrs. Dobbin?" asked the secretary with a most insinuating grin. Georgie burst out laughing and said, "By Jove, that was a good un." Emmy and the major blushed. We saw them from the stalls. "This lady is Mrs. George Osborne," said the major, "and this is her brother, Mr. Sedley, a distinguished officer of the Bengal Civil Service. Permit me to introduce him to your lordship." My lord nearly sent Joe's off his legs with the most fascinating smile. "Are you going to stop in Pumpernickel?" he said. "T. is a dull place, but we want some nice people, and we would try and make it so agreeable to you. Mr. Ahem, Mrs. Oho. I shall do myself the honor of calling upon you tomorrow at your inn. And he went away with a Parthian grin and glance which he thought must finish Mrs. Osborne completely. The performance over, the young fellows lounged about the lobbies, and we saw the society take its departure. The Duchess Dowager went off in her jingling old coach, attended by two faithful and withered old maids of honor, and a little snuffy spindle-shank gentleman in waiting, in a brown jersey and a green coat covered with orders, of which the star and the grand yellow cordon of the Order of St. Michael of Pumpernickel were most conspicuous. The drums rolled, the guard saluted, and the old carriage drove away. Then came His Transparency the Duke and Transparent Family, with his great officers of state and household. He bowed serenely to everybody. And amid the saluting of the guards, and the flaring of the torches of the running footmen, clad in scarlet, the transparent carriages drove away to the old Dussel Schloss, with its towers and pinnacles standing on the Schlossberg. Everybody in Pumpernickel knew everybody. No sooner was a foreigner seen there than the Minister of Foreign Affairs, or some other great or small officer of state, went round to the Erbprinz and found out the name of the new arrival. We watched them too, out of the theater. Tapeworm had just walked off, enveloped in his cloak, with which his gigantic chasseur was always in attendance, and looking as much as possible like Don Juan. The Prime Minister's lady had just squeezed herself into her sedan, and her daughter, the charming Ida, had put on her calash and clogs. When the English party came out, the boy yawning drearily, the major taking great pains in keeping the shawl over Mrs. Osborne's head, and Mr. Sedley looking grand, with a crush opera hat on one side of his head, and his hand in the stomach of a voluminous white waistcoat. We took off our hats to our acquaintances of the table d'hôte, and the lady, in return, presented us with a little smile and a curtsy, for which everybody might be thankful. The carriage from the inn, under the superintendence of the bustling Mr. Kirsch, was in waiting to convey the party, but the fat man said he would walk and smoke his cigar on his way homewards. So the other three, with nods and smiles to us, went without Mr. Sedley, Kirsch, with the cigar case, following in his master's wake. We all walked together, and talked to the stout gentleman about the adjournments of the place. It was very agreeable for the English. There were shooting parties and battues. There was a plenty of balls and entertainments at the hospitable court. The society was generally good, the theater excellent, and the living cheap. And our minister seems a most delightful and affable person, our new friend said. If such a representative, and a good medical man, I can fancy the place to be most eligible. Good night, gentlemen. And Joe's creaked up the stairs to bedward, followed by Kirsch with a flambeau. We rather hoped that nice-looking woman would be induced to stay some time in the town. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.